Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 190, and I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, as always, Jonathan Lindemann.
What's going on?
Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy.
And James Jones.
Hey.
JJ. The JJ. Yo. All right, we don't have anything to say up front, so we're going to jump into new business. This is where we talk about whatever it is we've been doing since the last time we recorded, and usually that consists of a bunch of video games. James, more
yes.
RPGs for you.
Yeah.
You're getting typecast at this point.
It's not intentional. It just happened.
Right, mm-hmm. James, right.
This is just what happened.
James, have you even started Pokemon?
No, I haven't even bought
man.
It yet.
You're so screwed. So you got to finish all these other RPGs so you can get to Pokemon.
Actually, there's another one in between that and Pokemon that I haven't even acquired yet.
Which one are you waiting to acquire?
Well, it depends on if we consider Fragile to be an RPG or not.
I think it's more of an adventure, but are you reviewing that, or are you just interested in it?
I just want it really badly.
You're just on the Support X Seed campaign?
No, I've wanted that game since, like, it was first announced, and then I was like, oh, good, it's never going to come to America. Well, fuck you, world.
But it is here. Fragile.
It is now.
Fragile
but
Dreams. Something.
It waited a very long time to get here.
It did. Yeah, I haven't actually played Fragile, but I think I've seen it in motion. I think it's really beautiful. Are you sure you'll be able to find a copy of it?
I will acquire it as I must.
Okay. So what have you actually been playing in the past week?
I beat Infinite Space, which is almost infinite, and then I took a couple days off because I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I then started to plow through Dragon Age Origins Awakening.
That's like the $40 expansion pack, right, for Dragon
yes.
Age?
Yes.
That you got for 20.
That I got for 20.
Oh,
yes.
Hey, well, yeah, I'm not gonna criticize you then.
Yeah. I had no intention of buying it this soon, but, you know,
right.
Deal's a deal. And to be honest, I couldn't stand to look at a DSi screen, XL or otherwise, for another 40 straight hours.
I think the brightness is just too much for you after all those years in the dark. With,
all those years of
the old fat DS is like Gollum going outside.
It was my come to Jesus moment.
So actually, before you talk about Dragon Age, how's the XL working out for you? You've had it for like a couple of weeks now, and you spoke about it a little bit last week. But it is such an upgrade for you going from that original DS. Do you feel like it's changed your life?
Once I get going with it, I don't really notice the difference, because for me, it wasn't a huge size increase. I mean, the screen's huge, but the system itself isn't really physically that much different in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of lock in on the screen anyway, so if it's small or big, it doesn't really make a big difference. I can see it either way. The fact that it is brighter helps with colors and stuff, but generally speaking, I played it in my room anyway, and my room is pretty well suited towards the old DS's lighting.
It's very dim.
the light in that room is very conducive to being able to play non-backlit or poorly backlit handheld systems, let's put it that way.
So it's like a ballpark in the evening.
Essentially, it's the lighting, it works well. Now, when I'm not playing it, like sitting around in my room or watching TV over in the other room where the lighting's not so good, like, say, you know, where the sun can visibly be seen or its effects are tangible in the area, then it's much better. Because, like, if the sun even threatened to cast itself upon the screen with the old DS, that was it. You couldn't see it anymore.
Yeah.
I seem to remember when I first got my DS Lite import from Japan, so this would have been, like, real early 2006, when I still lived in Alabama. I think I actually popped in Boktai, which is a GBA game.
Yes.
I popped that into the light, and I walked outside, and...
Holy God, I can play it!
Exactly. I went out, because Boktai is the game that has the sunlight sensor
yes.
in the cartridge. And so I walked out, and it was like, oh, this is awesome. I could actually play Boktai and see the screen at the same time. Because it used to be kind of one or the other. I mean, I remember on my GBA... Even on the SP to a lesser extent, but certainly on the original GBA, you pretty much had to play Boktai indoors with a really good light trained on the screen. And then once you got to a part where you really needed the sunlight, you'd kind of step out and let it charge up.
Yeah.
And then walk back inside. You just couldn't really play it in the sun, even though the game required you to play it in the sun.
It was a very, very big design mistake. Hey, let's make the game so it has to be played in the one condition that the Game Boy Advance is not made to be played in.
Yeah.
I wish they'd go back and make a new Boktai. That is such a cool game.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they kind of did. What was it, Lunar Nights?
Yeah, Lunar Nights.
Yeah, I haven't actually played Lunar Nights, but I know they took out the sun sensor.
They did.
Well, it was still something about it.
No. Your touchscreen had its own artificial sun.
No, but if
sun.
You put in the Boktai cart, that you, if your old GBA cut, it did something.
I mean, the sun sensor was more or less the gimmick, though. I mean, the game itself was still pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you right now, Lunar Knights is a game I would like to have on, like, a DS retroactive, because it's a game I totally miss. I never even played Boktai 2. I think maybe I played 2, but I never played 3 because it didn't come out in America.
Right. I forgot there was a Boktai 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a third one even in Japan, but it never came out here. And then Lunar Knights did, and it just came and went. And I remember Dan Bloodworth reviewed it for G4 or something, I think, when he was working there, and he really liked it.
Oh, it's really good. I got it at the back end right before it disappeared off store shelves.
Well, we've gotten far away from Dragon Age, so say your piece on that.
Well, to be fair, we actually never got there, so...
A little bit of a tangent.
We're in good shape there. So, Dragon Age, and we touched on this just before, is the Awakening is the expansion to the, as they point out on the box, the 2009 RPG of the year, Dragon Age Origins.
You're a shill.
No, I say it because I thought it was funny that they felt the need to point that out.
I know.
For an expansion pack.
For an expansion pack for a game you've already played.
Exactly. I think you've already sort of decided whether you think it's a really good RPG. You know, it's worth spending further money on.
I didn't think Dragon Age Origins was very good, but this box tells me it was actually Game of the Year. I should go buy the expansion.
I've revised my opinion. I'll spend $40 further.
What a bargain.
It just makes no sense.
Man, I just heard that they're charging $60 for StarCraft 2, even though it only has the first third of the story in it.
Yes, they are.
And that's a PC game, $60. Fuck you, Blizzard.
Welcome to Blizzard Activision.
Fuck Blizzard.
So, here's my biggest gripe with this game. It's got all the same problems and non-problems. Most people call them positive attributes.
Yeah, no.
I call them negative problems that the original game had, except that the story characterization is, the characters within the story are not as good, because they've essentially said, hey, all those characters that you met in the previous game, yeah, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, well, BioWare's had that problem with Mass Effect.
Yeah, they have, but I mean, I think you had one character carry over in Awakening, and then, well, Mass Effect, you had one.
In Mass Effect 2, you have Tali. Who carries over. She's the only character that's still... Well, no, there's one more. I don't want to spoil that. But then, like, if you look at the DLC for Mass Effect 2, we've got one character so far that's free, and he's pretty much a non-entity. I mean, he's good in combat, but, you know, story-wise...
Right, because he's not meant to be in there.
He might as well not be there. But he is meant to be in there. I mean, they programmed all these hooks in the game for him to be there. It's just that they didn't want to, you know, spend that much time. But the weird thing to me is now the next character, she's some kind of, like, space ninja or something.
Yeah, she is a space ninja.
And they're actually charging for her content.
Yes.
And apparently she's going to be just like Zaid. So even though you're actually paying for it this time, they're still not recording more than a handful of lines for her, you know. That's lame.
Which in a game that's all that's best attributes are its character interactions. That's kind
right,
of,
exactly.
Kind of shitty.
It's just I've heard that BioWare's had a lot of problems with DLC in the past. Like I never played any of it for the first Mass Effect, but I heard it was a mess, basically.
Yeah, the DLC you get for free in Dragon Age Origins is kind of shitty, to be honest.
Well, it just makes you wonder. I mean, they're doing Star Wars The Old Republic, the MMORPG, the Warcraft Killer, or whatever you want to call it. And
yeah, right.
It's like...
Nerd Fantasy 101, basically.
Based on what they've done so far with, you know, being able to expand their worlds and keep them updated over time, which is what an MMO is all about, they don't seem to be doing a very good job of it over the past few years. And I just wonder, I mean, are they really going to be able to step up their game for an MMO? Because, you know, like, a really, really well-done Star Wars game from BioWare, who've now made a couple of things that I really like in the Mass Effect franchise, which is similar to Star Wars
which
in some
is basically
ways.
Star Wars without Jedi.
No, it's more like Star Trek, but, I mean, it's similar enough. Like, that is an MMORPG I could conceivably be attracted to. But given their track record with this kind of stuff so far, it just makes me wonder if they're really prepared to handle that kind of a model.
The problem with a lot of their DLC is that it just doesn't feel as tight as the rest of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not. I mean, it doesn't have the same story hooks that the rest of the game has.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's an MMO, you aren't quite as concerned about the story hooks because it's more of a...
Oh, but you are in the Old Republic, you are. They've said it's all about the story.
Yeah, but you can't tell a story in an MMO the same way as you can in a single player game. I mean,
they're trying to, though.
It depends. I mean, you can.
No, because everybody's on a different place in the story than you.
Oh, here we go. I'm not having this conversation again. You can definitely tell a story through quests, though. You can definitely do that.
That's what they're going to be doing. But, you know, with an MMO, I mean, you expect them to keep adding more quests and more stuff like that. And then presumably they'll have some kind of WoW type of, you know, Frozen Throne or Wrath of the Lich King or whatever kind of expansion over time. And you just have to wonder, like, what if all the quests that they add in the Old Republic are shitty compared to the ones that came on the disc? Because in an MMO, that's more of a problem because the game is a lot more leveraged on them adding material to it.
I guess it just merits, being an MMO, it just merits a completely different approach from the ground up, though.
Yeah. But James, I guess the question I have to go back to Dragon Age and the expansion is, does Awakenings, is it basically just a big battle pack?
Well, see, here's what's weird about it, is that unlike Mass Effect 2, which has lots of hooks into what you did in Mass Effect 1, which is pretty ambitious since they're different fucking games, this is an expansion pack to another game, which means it's really heavily leveraged on your previous game. Mm-hmm. And yet I see almost nothing that is affected by what I did in the main game story.
It's probably done by a different team, right? Because I mean, this is only coming out like 4 months after the original game. So there's no way, I mean, there's no way they started on this after they finished the disc.
Yeah.
It's not like they didn't know what the script already called for in the original.
Well, these are certainly not problems that we have to wrestle with Nintendo titles.
No, it's not.
For better or worse, it just doesn't come into play.
It kind of hurts a little bit because you're like, well, all that shit I did is worthless, huh? All those decisions I made really had no effect on the world whatsoever, eh?
I will say that a lot of times, you know, I have all three consoles and a PC too, and or two PCs, but when I turn on the Wii, a lot of times I feel like that's the no-strings-attached console. Like, that's the one I can turn on and just fuck around and play something maybe simpler, a lot of times simpler, based on the library that I have. But I can turn it on and, well, at least I don't have to worry about, you know, trying to get achievements or seeing what other people are doing. I mean, sometimes I want to do that stuff. But mm-hmm. with Wii, I turn it on, I just know I'm going to jump into a game and play it. When I'm done, I'm going to turn it off.
Yep.
And certainly there are experiences that you can have like that on the other systems. But because of just the infrastructures that are in place, very few games actually allow you to do that. That's one thing I like about, like, the arcade games and the downloadable, like, PSN titles, is that they're more like stuff you get on Wii, because you just kind of jump into it and play it, and when you're done, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
There's part of me that really likes that kind of just, yeah, I'm going to pick this up, and I'm going to go fuck things up for about an hour, and then I'll be done with it. But then there's part of me that really needs that kind of feedback loop that some more attached experiences give you.
Yeah, oh yeah, I like both, but what I was saying is it's nice to have access to both.
Yeah, and you can get both on all four systems.
I think Wii has fewer persistent game experiences.
Oh yeah, definitely. But
to option from. I mean, there are some.
Yeah.
But most of the ones that they have, I kind of wore out long ago. I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be that way. That's a consequence of what's out on it, you know?
Well, I mean, that's a consequence of the culture that Nintendo itself maintains. I mean,
it's true. I honestly think, and we're getting a little meta here, but I honestly think that a lot of companies, for all their talk about, you know, being innovative and thinking outside the box when they make Wii games, they really just copy Nintendo.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. it's been that way for years.
To a far more extent than they do on, you know, like a company like Ubisoft, I think, is incredibly innovative on other systems with things like Assassin's Creed. That's not like any other, it's not like anything except Prince of Persia, which is theirs too. But, you know, and then you look at what they put on Wii, and it's like Rayman Raving Rabbits, which is an okay game, but it's clearly based on things that Nintendo had already done in terms of tech demos and stuff, so.
Well, it's not even with the Wii, though. That happened with the GameCube, too. I mean, there were games made the GameCube that you're like, this is a basically rebranded Nintendo game, and worse.
Mm-hmm. People get really gun-shy on Nintendo platforms. They feel like because people buy Nintendo platforms primarily to play Nintendo games, that whatever these third parties make, they should be a lot like Nintendo games too to have a chance of succeeding. And personally, I think that's totally backwards. I don't want to play more stuff like Nintendo because you're not going to make it as good as Nintendo made it. So why don't you do what you're good at?
And that's kind of what happened with Monster Hunter 3, it looks like, where they basically said, we're going to make our game on this system and make no changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough. It may not be what I want, but I mean, at least they're not aping Nintendo. And there's nothing else like it on the system.
Yeah, so even if it's basically being played with the PSP controller, we just don't care because we're gonna make the game that we make.
Mm-hmm. See, I think Boombox is the best example. They're like that. That is not a copy of anything Nintendo has done, not even remotely. That is an innovative Wii game. That's somebody really looking at this and saying, what can we do with these controls that is fun and awesome and hasn't been done before? And man, they did it. Anyway, we haven't talked about Dragon Age in a few minutes, so I see no reason to go back to it. My new business derailed the fuck out of your new business, dude.
Fuck you.
So mine is, well, I did play a lot of Final Fantasy 13. I'm like almost 20 hours into it. I'm not going to talk about it this week because really everything I've gone into so far has been kind of more of the same. There's been a lot of good story development. The battle system hasn't changed that much since last week. So there's not a whole, I mean, it's still interesting to me. I still want to keep playing it, but for you guys, probably not much to talk about. So what did I do? Two Wii games, No More Heroes 2. I went back to it and it had just been kind of sitting there half complete for a while. And I was like, I really want to finish this. You know, I want to complete it. So I put it back in, played it a bunch more and, got to the final boss. So at this point, the final boss is a real bastard and I don't know if I'll ever complete it. I do this a lot of times. Well, I really hate final bosses that are inordinately more difficult than the rest of the game because I don't have the patience. It's like, as I get to the end of the game, I have even less gumption to finish it than I did earlier. Sorry, that's just the way I am. It's like, I'm tired of this game. I'm ready for it to be over. I'm not going to redouble or retriple my efforts to get over the last half of a percent of this game. I've already gotten my money's worth. I've already beaten almost the entire thing. I don't really care enough. So if you want me to see the ending, you better just show it to me.
Johnny literally could not play games any more antithetical to how I play them, which is basically like, I'm at the end of this game. You need to fucking die.
Right. No, the way you did the whole, what was it, Infinite Undiscovery or...
No, it was Last Remnant.
Last Remnant, the other one, yeah.
Yeah.
The way you did Last Remnant and took forever.
Well, because my Xbox fucking died, for one.
I've got so many games that I got to the very end of and just quit because they got frustrating and I just don't give a shit.
Mm. Yeah.
Even Final Fantasy games, I've done that where I'll get to the last boss and it's just ridiculously hard and I'm like, I don't care.
I almost get disappointed if I can steamroll the last boss. Like, I steamrolled the last boss of Infinite Space.
And I'm glad because I can move on to the next game.
And I was upset. I was like, you know, I finally figured this battle system out and then I fucking get this guy? This guy went down like a little bitch. What's wrong with this game?
Well, anyway, No More Heroes 2 is a good game. You know, I know Carl talked about it a lot on the Drunk Cast and I've mentioned it before on here, back when I first got it, but it's really more the same from the first No More Heroes, so if you like that, you'll like this. I don't think it's really going to convert a whole lot of people who didn't like the first one, because the gameplay, they cut out a lot of bullshit, but they didn't really add anything new into it. So there's just more of the good parts, basically. Mm. But they didn't really try to improve the good parts, and that's kind of my problem with it, is like, man, I mean, when you get to the next to last stage and they throw you in a parking lot and have you kill over 100 guys who put up little or no fight, it's like, really, guys? I mean, you didn't get this out of your system last time?
Yeah, that's like one of those stupid, like, collect money fight missions in the first one, but, like, in the main game.
yeah, it's just this... we talked about kill rooms, you know, and this is literally a kill room that just goes on for 20 minutes. And I'm just cutting guys in half for 20 minutes. I'm so bored. I'm like, give me a fucking break. Let me fight the boss. That's the only good part of this game is the boss. So let me fight the boss. Why do I have to go through all this other crap?
I can remember the real low point of No More Heroes 1, which tested my resolve to actually keep going with the game. Which I did end up finishing it. But it was this part where you were literally walking in a straight line, just killing guys.
Oh, the baseball diamond?
No, it's not the baseball diamond. You walk in a straight line for ages, killing guys. It's just going on too long, and you know they're just this bog standard enemy sort of effort. And then And then you get to the boss, except it's like a fake out, and you have this sort of comedy cutscene, and there is no boss.
Yeah. Oh, well, Greg, okay. You'll be happy to know that boss comes back in the sequel, and you actually fight him this time.
Which is great, but
So basically, the game trolls you, essentially.
I reflected on how many coconuts I collected, how much trash I speared, and then all those idiots I killed on that corridor to do nothing.
I do like that he's a game developer brave enough to troll his own players as he makes the game.
Oh, well, I mean, he and Hideo Kojima are a match made in heaven, because they're both basically douchebag game designers. and they make some good things. I mean, their games have a lot of good qualities, but put together, those guys are going to make... They're just going to grief their fans, is what they're going to do.
They completely do.
Seriously. That's exactly what's going to happen whenever their game gets announced. It's going to be, like, the most bullshit...
Actually, the big griefing probably is that there is no game.
It will be Carl's game of the decade.
They will grief Carl, and he will love them for it.
Oh, man, he will. I'm just messing with Carl, but No More Heroes 2 is like, the bosses continue to be pretty good. I mean, they occasionally get frustrating because of camera issues or whatnot, but the bosses are almost all really good. But the stuff in between the bosses, although there's less in between the bosses, is still not good. And I'm not talking about the mini games, because the little 8-bit mini games are totally optional. I mean, at no point do you have to do these. And the other thing is, there's only like 7 or 8 of them. So about halfway through the game, you've unlocked all of those, and you've bought everything that you need money for. You know, you've got the couple of beam swords that you can purchase, and you've upgraded at the gym, and you're maxed out. So you can go back and play those games for fun, which is great, but you've lost the overarching, you know, reason to collect money and to play these games. And so it gets to where, like, the final 4 or 5 ranking fights, you just go straight from boss to boss. I mean, there's just nothing in between. And when they do put things in between, it's like the motorcycle level, where you ride on your motorcycle for 5 minutes and there are no obstacles that can slow you down, nothing to kill you, there are no enemies, there are no turns. You just ride your motorcycle in a straight line for 5 minutes.
I love that.
What the fuck? That's not even a game. It's like a cutscene where you can move back and forth. It boggles the mind. It really does.
I think it's genius, actually. I think it's avant-garde, and you'll just never understand.
It's beyond you.
It's definitely avant-garde.
It's so artistic, it's just beyond you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the pianist who wrote the piece that's like 4.5 minutes long, where he... You know,
he
goes to
there.
The piano,
yes.
And he holds his fingers over the keyboard and doesn't play for 4.5 minutes, and he gets up and leaves.
It's like 4 minutes. The song's like called 4 minutes 38 seconds, and that's exactly what he does. He just
sits
there.
It's just silence. Yeah,
it's meant to make you think, guys. Come on,
Suda 5-1 always trying to get things under your head rather than over it. I think
under your skin, more like it.
I like that we've basically just sidetracked 2 new businesses in a row now.
Yeah. I'm still talking about No More Heroes. It's sad because the parts of it that are actually a game are good, and I like them.
Well, then, but, I mean, if we were to review it, you could only review the parts that are a game, so technically.
No, there's presentation and everything, and...
Zero. Fuck this game.
It just annoys me, and I do actually, I really believe that No More Heroes 2 is much better in the first half. And it really feels like it just runs out of steam. I mean, that's one reason that I just want to get it over with, is that the last half of the game has been a lot less enjoyable than the first half. Because you run out of things to do. It just gets to the point where you're just running around slashing the same guys that you were 2 years ago, you know?
Mm.
The other Wii game that I've been playing a little bit is Ghostbusters. You know, this came out like last summer, and the main reason I wanted to play it is that I'd heard at the time that the Wii version was probably the best of all the different platforms, which is intriguing. You know, when you hear that, it doesn't happen very often. And I love the original Ghostbusters movie. I mean, I kind of have a soft spot for the sequel too, because it came out when I was old enough to go to movies. And so I actually saw that one in the theater. It was one of the first movies I saw in the theater, probably. But the video game is kind of weak, actually. I mean, it worries me that the Wii version is supposedly the best, because the other ones must be pretty bad. I mean, the Wii version's not terrible, but it's just very, very mediocre feeling to me. I mean, I guess the graphics are okay. It's by the guys who did Mushroom Men. They're called Redfly Studios, and I haven't really played Mushroom Men. Don't really have any interest in it, but Ghostbusters, it looks nice. It basically is kind of like a more grandiose Elebits, because you're just pointing a cursor at the screen and you know, blowing up things with your photon beam, your proton pack, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you move something around, you know, it becomes like a tractor beam and you move things around. And that's about it. And that would be okay. I mean, the gameplay is definitely simple. And it does have a bit of Luigi's Mansion vibe to it. It's not nearly as charming as Luigi's Mansion, which, if you can imagine Luigi's Mansion without the charm, there's not that much left.
Yeah, it's just not a whole lot there.
It's just
Mansion. And that's kind of how Ghostbusters feels, because, I mean, it was a really poor decision on their part. Even though the game is set like 5 years after the movies, the first three or four levels are things that were in the first movie, basically. So you start by going to the hotel where Slimer is. And then you fight Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and then you go to the library and fight the Gray Lady. These are all things that you're familiar with, but now in the video game, you get to go through them again, except they're not funny anymore. And it's really sad, but the writing is just not good. The acting is not good. I mean, they got all the original actors, pretty much, and it's just such a waste, because there's no material for them to work with, and like people like Bill Murray, who... you know, I think is hysterical in the original Ghostbusters movie. All his lines come across really flat. The lip syncing is bad, so you lose, you know, all the great, a lot of his comedy is about things going on in his face and his comic timing, and those are thrown off completely by the technology. So it's just not funny.
It's funny because I think people said the same things about the HD versions, even though obviously the art style and the graphical fidelity is completely different.
Well, I'm sure the script is the same. But in terms of
like the lip syncing and the facial stuff, like, of course, they went with these like weird caricatures for the Wii version, so I could see how it might be difficult to like convey subtle little body language tics or whatever with that. Whereas like even with the HD versions, like if that was the lead platform for the dramatic side, if you want to put it that way, still didn't really work out that well. Mm-hmm.
It's really too bad. I mean, I don't know why my hopes were set higher, because, you know, Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis wrote the script, and Harold Ramis actually has the best performance of the four Ghostbusters in the game, but I mean, it's like, when was the last time Dan Aykroyd was funny? 20 years ago? I'm serious. I mean, Bill Murray has certainly continued to make some interesting films.
Rushmore.
Well, I would say that he has his batting average has dropped significantly, though.
Sure, yeah, since Lost in Translation, Rushmore, and Groundhog Day and all that. But Dan Aykroyd really...
His batting average is zero, I think.
He's been demoted to
AAA. I don't even think I've seen Dan Aykroyd in a movie since the Coneheads sequel.
Oh, dear God.
I mean, I'm trying to think of anything else. I've heard him on the radio doing his Elwood Blues thing.
I see him doing like UFO shit or whatever on TV.
He's really totally lost his sense of humor.
I agree.
It's sad. It's really, the writing is not funny at all. It's really bad. So I'm not gonna play much more Ghostbusters. I've put like an hour into it and I'm done, man. It's really not that entertaining.
That is very.
It is sad. I was looking forward to it, but yeah. So anyway, Greg, on to you, sir.
Yeah, well, before I get on to what I've been playing, it's an interesting little story that just popped up today I thought I'd bring up, is that they did the Q2 release schedule for Europe today.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the thing is, they had the media summit not so long ago where they pretty much did that with the major titles, so there wasn't anything particularly, you know, revelatory in it, it would seem. But then it turns out that, in fact, they're just very slyly bringing out Daigasso Band Brothers in Europe in May.
What? That game's like 4 years old.
Yeah.
Well, it's unclear whether it's going to be the DX version or what, whether it's going to be like an Elite Beat Agents kind of thing where it's neither one or two, sort of.
Yeah.
Hopefully it will have all the functionality of DX, because that's got quite a surprising amount of functionality. So you've got... Yeah, online stuff with the Wi-Fi connection, getting songs. It was also one of the rare cases of Wii DS connectivity where they had a channel in Japan where you could download the channel and sync it up to the DS and actually play the songs through the Wii and the television sound system.
Oh, cool.
So it obviously sounded a lot better than it would through the DS speakers.
Was DX like a full-on sequel on a DS card? Because I know at one point they brought out a Game Boy cartridge that was like an expansion pack for Band Brothers.
There was an expansion pack, but the Band Brothers DX is a full sequel that came out in 2008 in Japan, I believe.
Okay, so it's only 2 years old.
Yeah, that's much more recent, and so I guess maybe that's why this kind of makes a little more sense. But it it is going to be called Jam with the Band, which is what we thought it was going to be called when we were talking about bringing back the original Band Brothers years and years ago, when it was a launch title for the DS in Japan. I think pretty much they had said they would bring it out at least in America, I think, as Jam with the Band, but then they never did. So I just thought that was really random. I guess it's similar to things we've seen in America, like Starfy, just out of nowhere. They just kind of pull that.
Yeah. Hey guys, guess what?
Ha! We see what they do with the sound, the track list, all that kind of stuff, and just how much they try and market it, really. They certainly seem to be adopting a low-key approach so far.
But that's fine. It's probably a niche game, but it's awesome that it's coming out. And it'll be in English, so I mean, we could even import it for America.
I'm just glad it got off the Island of Misfit Toys.
Is that what Japan is to you, John?
Apparently that's what it is to Nintendo sometimes.
That's really funny.
NOE has really turned into like the completely unpredictable random cousin of the other two.
There are some strange things with NOE, obviously. A lot of things like Trace Memory, another code R, which is so text-heavy, and they decided
let's do this, it'll be good.
For all the European languages, whereas America didn't.
Yeah, the region where that is the biggest hurdle, they're like, fuck it, let's go.
It seems like in Europe, Nintendo is just getting like all open and more liberal. I mean, before you know it, they're going to have nude beaches.
Nintendo nude beaches.
You know what we won't stand for here? Transforming robot vehicles.
Oh, excitement.
Unacceptable.
Get out of here, transforming robot vehicles.
I just wonder if that's a case of, you know, because Excitebots was developed in America, maybe Nintendo of Europe just...
I thought Obama made it all better. I thought we liked you now.
I just mean that maybe Nintendo of Europe... You know, I don't think Excitebots came out in Japan either. It's more a fact of, like, you know, Nintendo of America was the only subsidiary to publish that game.
You just say the NCL and NOE were saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And Reggie was like, I'm doing it.
It's like, NOE made it. Like, no, it's ours. You can't have
it. I think it's more likely, actually, that the people at NOE who make these decisions just weren't that really aware of Excitebots because they weren't being shown by Japan, which is what they're used to. And it wasn't being made under their noses, like something like Battalion Wars 2. And so, you know, I mean, I don't know if there are any other examples of Wii games that were developed in America that didn't come out in Europe, but I just wonder if maybe it was just some kind of miscommunication among the different branches.
It's so weird. I was going to save this for 2 weeks from there, but since it's come up, 2 weeks from there will be the 1 year anniversary of the Excite Strike.
We'll throw a party.
Amazing.
We come not to praise Excitebots, but to bury it.
On that day, I shall put my disc in and play it again.
No, that would be nice. But we should start a new one, actually, because Cave Story came out in America. We still haven't got a European date.
So
basically, in the case of Excitebots, Johnny, your telling of it is that, is it Satoru Shibata that's in charge of NOE right now?
It is someone Japanese.
I think that's it. I think it was basically the home islands that didn't call him about Excitebots.
What I'm proposing as a potential explanation for the whole Excitebots fiasco is that maybe Nintendo Europe talks to Nintendo Japan, and Nintendo of America talks to Nintendo Japan, but Nintendo of America doesn't really talk to Nintendo of Europe.
Well, they did, though. There's some curious cases where Europe just follows literally along with Japan. Like, for instance, the names of those DSi games, where they take little bits of existing games. Though in America, they're called Express, right? So Dr. Mario Express.
Right.
But over here, they are the pretty much the literal translations of what they are in Japan. So it's a little bit of... Dr. Mario. Which... is just terrible. But it's like, but it's faithful to what NCL's doing, so it must be right.
It's like, maybe at the next media event, Reggie should go ahead and swap business cards with his NOE counterpart. Here, just call me.
Well, if you think about it, this kind of structure, it actually kind of makes sense, because I think my guess is that in previous generations, you know, in past years, Nintendo of Europe has largely followed Nintendo of America.
On a very considerable lag.
Yeah, exactly.
Many years.
And their fans were always complaining, right? And so Nintendo of Europe said, well, instead of waiting to do what America does, except 6 months later or worse, why don't we just do what Japan is doing, and that'll put us way up on the timeline, and we'll save a lot of time and be able to serve our people better. And I mean, you know, you're not complaining, are you, Greg?
Well, it's been so many improvements in what's been going on. You can't argue with that in general.
It's just become more unpredictable, essentially.
Very much less predictable.
I mean, it may be that Nintendo puts more resources behind them now than they did in the past, too. I mean,
I'm certain of that, because the market is...
It's a big-ass market. I mean, they should.
Yeah.
I'd like to think my major accomplishment of this episode is getting Greg to talk about gaming in Europe.
They'll be back. We'll be back to Japanese virtual console soon enough.
So Greg, what have you actually been playing the past week?
I've been playing mostly Pokemon Soul Silver. This is the second go round for me with Pokemon. The first one was Pearl 3 years ago now, so I felt pretty much ready to sort of go around again. And yeah, it's been very much what I expected. The high esteem, the reputation of the original Gold and Silver games helped. You know, the nice things that James said on the Games of the Decade thing, for instance, as well. And you know, it is just a really impeccable sort of experience for the most part. You still can't. It's got to be the most ruthlessly effective handheld time killer.
Oh, it's horrible.
Greg, I gotta imagine that for you going back to play Soul Silver after getting your start with Pearl is kind of like Marty McFly going back to 1885 and finding out that all of his friends' grandparents look exactly like their grandkids.
Yeah, they do look exactly like them, don't they? In their Back to the Future.
Was that strained at all?
No. I mean, you know, I'm just so well prepared for what was to come. It is exactly what I was expecting, but I mean, it still just works very well for what I want it to, you know, on your travel journeys or the other, like, has been talked about plenty, it's all absent-minded playing on the, you know, when you're sort of doing something else. Yeah, you know, I've racked up over 20 hours already.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, when you think about that, it's
that's
like, for another, there's so many like games I really like that I have not played that much ever. But with this, it's like I've only got the first like 8 badges or whatever. There's still ages to go, because of course you have the sort of second quest where you go back.
Right. There's a whole second world. That's the only games that do it too, which is kind of disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, we've had people on staff put like 200-300 hours into Pokemon.
Yo.
Well, even, I mean, like I said, I'm not like some really ardent Pokemon player or somebody who knows all the intricacies, all the ins and outs and the minutiae and all that. I put 120 hours into the first one, at least, into Pearl. I mean, I don't even know how I did it.
It just sneaks up on you and gets you.
One day that number hits 300 hours and you're like, what happened?
Yeah.
I have wasted my life.
My life was wasted.
I certainly know it could be far more than that even, you know, and so it's no doubt, it's just compelling in a very weird way, especially for me who's not generally an RPG guy. Yeah, but it still has that sort of effect. I mean, playing through this now, I think they're definitely just in the sort of, you know, the standard kind of single player quest part of it, which I'm in at the minute. The best parts, my absolute favourite parts, are where you kind of come up against, you know, high level Pokemon opponent who you really are not set up to beat, given the team of Pokemon you've developed up to that point. So then you've got to devise some kind of cockamamie strategy in order to beat this guy. For instance, stuff like, you know, like, I think it was Poliwrath, who's a water fighter type.
Yes.
And I've got a Typhlosion, the fire starter guy. So I didn't have a good way to beat him. And then it's like, how am I going to beat him? And it's like, well, if I get Magneton in there and I paralyze him first, and then, you know, I could sort of chip away for a while, and then once he's used up the potion I know he's going to use, then I bring out Geodude and self-destruct and kill it, and that's that. You know, that's
strategy.
Really,
yeah.
That's really fun, that stuff. The other stuff where it's just like, oh, I have the right Pokemon for this. Dead.
Yeah, it's...
And I think the point is that I think in subsequent Pokemon games, they need to find a way to get more of that, what I'm talking about, where you kind of, you know, try to really use everything at your disposal and get into a more prolonged battle with these guys to take them down. They need to find a way to leverage that more in the experience, I think, to make it even more
enjoyable. In some of the later battles, at least in Silver, so in that whole second quest garbage, you run into things where it's like, oh, she's a ghost trainer, I can take care of her, and then they'll come out with some weird-ass move on there that there's no reason they should have.
Yeah.
That just kills you, and you're like, what the fuck was that?
I mean, again, yeah, that is important, because the thing with the whole like gym structure is that you're going to be dealing with all these Pokemon of the same type, broadly speaking. So, you know, if you pick the fire guy and you go to the grass gym, that isn't going to be much of an interesting endeavor.
But they'll surprise you sometimes.
Yeah, they'll pull
out. So that's why you do have to put these wrinkles in. And I just wish there were a few more of them, really.
Well, Greg, this might seem like a stretch, but because you say that's like your favorite part of Pokemon is that kind of strategic battle situation that you get thrown into, you're right. I mean, in Pokemon, you're not going to find much of that except when you're in the gyms or you're fighting the Final Four or something
like
that.
Yeah, definitely then.
Another game that I would seriously suggest that you might actually like based on that preference is Final Fantasy XIII, because the whole game is kind of set up to create those situations, and there is no random shitty, you know, jump in there and just murder everybody. I mean, it just really doesn't do that. So
yeah, that's what I really like about the sound of Final Fantasy XIII. The problem I've got with it is it's a hugely long game that's not portable.
True.
Like,
true.
I can't play console games for that long. There's the way my lifestyle is, my preferences.
You can do it 30 minutes at a time. There's a lot of save points.
I just find it difficult to maintain interest so much with that. That's what I've said before, but I like playing RPGs on portables. It just lends itself better.
I'm just thinking, it's too bad there's not a remote play option for that one. So you can play it on a PS4.
They made it too beautiful for that.
They have, yeah. But there are some games you can do that.
Well, I see, that's kind of the same reason I tend to marathon those games when I'm playing them. So I'll basically put a whole weekend into them. Because it lets me keep momentum going.
Yeah, because I mean, with a story experience, I mean, momentum, I think, is important. It kind of goes back to what I was talking with Silent Hill last week. You know, it's really easy to maintain momentum with that because it's so short.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But with a longer game, yeah, I probably would have to do what you do, James, and that would be difficult for me. Not least on weekends, because the marathon I'm doing is editing this podcast. Yeah.
So one of the nice things that FF13 does is that every time you boot up the game and load your save file, the loading screen is a summary of the most recent story developments.
That's a great idea.
Over the past 30 minutes or an hour of playing before you stop playing the last time. So as soon as if you're making a sandwich, then you may not see it, but it actually waits for you to press a button, so you always have a chance to read it before you actually jump into the game. But it's really nice. It actually keeps you engaged even if you take a few days off of it and then go back, as I have. So
I always like games that have journals like that, or that you can like go through and just page back kind of thing.
It has a pretty extensive like log of all the cutscene. I think you can go back and watch most of the movies as well, but it also just has like a text version of like everything that's happened so far. So, Greg, anything else you wanted to say about Pokemon? Are you doing the Pokewalker?
I've been using the Pokewalker a little bit. You know, it's mostly kind of trivial kind of stuff, but it's a cool little idea to kind of incentivize you to play around with this sort of added dimension to the game, and you know, just it keeps track of your steps and everything, and you can catch Pokemon on these routes that you unlock by walking.
Yes.
So you could catch Pokemon that you wouldn't necessarily be finding at that particular point that you're at in the game, and you could do the Poke Bump, I think they called it on Active Time Babble, where you know if you've got someone else with a Poke Walker, you just sort of communicate with them and you get items and stuff like that. So I'm sure it's a big hit on playgrounds or at PAX East or
PAX East, where people would walk the line and be like, "Bump me." And they'd basically stop at every person they saw that had one and get upset if you said no.
Yeah, they would stand there in line and be like, "I got a Pokewalker!" And like five people would put up their hands, and it was like they were like, you know, Pokebuskers.
Pocket Buskers. Oh my god, that's great. Oh. That's great.
Poke busking John, out there in the PAX line.
John, I've never heard you talk much about Pokemon. What is your experience level with that series?
He's got a Pikachu body pillow.
I had, I have Pearl. I've played a couple of them, but the thing is, I feel like there's really not much to say about them because they've started to become the same thing every time. I mean, they're all really.
I completely agree.
I mean, they're all really well crafted. I think they're brilliant. I think the actual core game is amazing. But every time it's just new Pokemon with a couple of tweaks here and there. Like, this time you can go underground. This time you can play online. This time you can use the Pokewalker.
I feel like that series needs a reboot. I think they need to, like, go back to the drawing board and make drastic cuts to features. And I told James this, but I feel like, and a lot of fans will not like this direction, but I think the next Pokemon game, the Generation 6 or 7 or whatever they're doing, I think they should totally forgo compatibility with previous versions. I think that feature is really nice for fans of the series who want to get all the different games, but I think it's really holding them down because it forces each game to be so similar to the other ones so that everything will be compatible.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, just the fact that it is so bloody successful. I mean, how much they sell is bound to build in this conservatism. And certainly, you look at the homeland, you look at Japan, your Dragon Quest doesn't necessarily change that much. You know, it's something about something about Japan that when you have a formula that works, you can keep hitting it, and there isn't much of an incentive to change. I mean, to be honest, I just think that perhaps what they really should do is get more adventurous with the quote-unquote, spin-off titles or whatever, in terms of doing things with them that are more...
You mean like Pokemon Dash 2?
No, I mean, I just mean something that is... take for instance what they do with Final Fantasy, stuff like Crystal Chronicles and stuff, which it isn't mainline Final Fantasy, but it's not like completely divorced from Final Fantasy. It's not Final Fantasy Pinball.
Well, I would disagree that Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles isn't effectively divorced from the Final Fantasy lineage.
But in terms of it's scratching some of the same itches, it's not necessarily a completely separate
Although Pokemon
genre.
Pinball might scratch more of the Pokemon itch than you would imagine, actually.
It's a great game.
It's very,
very
good at that.
It's famously excellent game. It's funny, actually, because they did one for GBA, but they haven't done one for DS.
No, they haven't.
Yeah, I've never played the...
It's more of the same, essentially.
The GBA one, I never played it.
The thing about how they manage the spin-offs...
They don't. I don't think they manage them at all.
They did originally. It was like they were all tied into a previous mainline release, so there'd be a mainline release... And then somewhat down the road, there would be a completely whacked out spinoff.
Like Pokemon Coliseum?
Yeah. And then
they were like add-ons.
By the way, if you wanted to play battles that were way harder than normal ones, that was where you got it, against the AI in that game.
Oh, yeah. That's my problem with all the arena games. And there's one on, there's a Battle Royale or whatever.
Battle Revolution.
Yeah.
It was a very early Wii game that was compatible with those games. And the problem with those games is that because they are only battles...
Yeah.
There's no meat to the game. It's just battles. That's all you can do.
Well, the only one they ever did anything close was Gale of Darkness, and that wasn't very good.
Yeah, and they had some bad kind of like attempts at doing a weird RPG on GameCube, but I think XD had some what a terrible name, but I think XD had some RPG stuff too. It had some good music for sure, but the arena games, because they are just battles, they make the battles crazy hardcore and totally inaccessible.
Yeah, like I never finished the last tier of battles in... I think I had the second N64 arena game, but I could beat every person in the game, in the actual game itself, with like one Pokemon.
Yeah.
But that team? No. Destroyed. Constantly, constantly crushed every time I tried that last tier. I was like, I'm gonna do it this... Fuck!
Yeah. But I think actually Battle Revolution on Wii was one of the first online Wii game. Does that sound right?
It does sound right.
Could be, yeah.
But But essentially, it was just a graphical skin for the DS game, which was also already online.
And it was a lot harder to sell that because the DS game already had online battles, and in general just had much better online features, period.
And it doesn't look great, to be honest. I mean, the visual element it's giving you is not particularly gorgeous. I can't believe they've never done a Battle Revolution or Colosseum game with cel-shaded graphics. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer. Like, make it look like the show. Make them feel like now you're having battles that look like something that might be on the cartoon. And they look, they just look like plastic or plasticine
like
models.
Toys.
They look awful. I don't get it.
This is going to get cut, but I know that...
Go ahead, then.
What always really annoyed me about the Colosseum games was, just like the real games, they didn't actually animate the attacks on each other.
It's lazy bullshit.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, when that's the whole game, is like visualizing those battles more in more detail. Incredibly lazy.
My thought was, is it laziness or is it concern that they were worried that if they actually animated the violence, it might do something to their rating, or
they might get a T rating.
Yeah,
I mean, Smash Brothers has a T rating. That's weak.
But if it looks like the cartoon and the cartoons on children's television?
Because TV shows and games are treated differently. I mean,
they are.
But I mean, it'd be interesting because the information on Generation 5, I think, is going to come out in the next week or so from when we're recording this.
They announced, about a month, 2 months ago now, they announced two Pokemon from the next generation, and I think they're going to start releasing more information about, you know, the world and the game itself.
Yeah. See, I feel like instead of introducing new Pokemon, they should introduce some poison to the Pokemon food supply and kill off about 3/4 of them.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding here. I mean, I really think they would do themselves a favor by getting rid of a lot of the classic Pokemon, because there's just too many of them.
A poke extinction, if you will.
Well, the thing is, I mean, they could do so much more with the graphics, with the battle strategies, with allowing the players to develop a Nintendogs-like attachment to their Pokemon. If they just had fewer of them to work with, they could put more effort into them.
Well, they could also do so much more with the world, too. I mean, I just feel the way it is now, I mean, there's the entire Pokemon world, they aren't really doing much to flesh it out. So.
Well, really, the only personality the world has is that everybody's crazy about Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
And crazy is the literal term to use here, because they're arming children with deadly monsters and sending them out to the world at 8 years old.
But the monsters only attack each other. They don't attack people.
They're still freaking dangerous. They set things on fire.
That's true. Those are the wild ones, though, right?
But then they can also be caught in big balls, so it's cockfighting for kids, guys. Come on.
Damn it.
But it is. That is exactly what Pokemon is.
They actually equate it to giant beetle fighting, which I guess is popular amongst kids in Japan.
These interesting. The world is a wondrous place, truly.
But you don't train beetles. You train dogs and roosters to fight. You can't train a beetle. It's not smart enough. I've tried. No, I'm kidding.
You can beef it up. Put some weights on its back and make it walk around.
That's right.
John.
Okay.
Now that we've warmed you up, John.
I still have new business.
What is your new business, sir?
My new business is Weapon of Choice, which I know Johnny has a soft spot for Weapon of Choice for Mommy's Best Games.
I actually have a pretty hard spot for Weapon of Choice.
Oh, no.
The world's gone bad.
I'm not making the inappropriate comments here.
See, I felt kind of left out last week with the Choaniki because I didn't have any prepared triple entendres. So
John had a notebook.
It's triple, isn't it? Really, it's like it's too explicit to be double, so it kind of comes back around.
The World of Goo as the sequel is probably as far as John's ever taken anything.
It's a spiritual successor to it. So Weapon of Choice, very much Mommy's Best Games take on Contra, but pretty cool. I think it's really cool because it's almost kind of a blending of sort of an open world kind of philosophy and, you know, old school Contra, because the Weapon of Choice part, the choice in the title, is actually kind of refers to the path choices that you can make, because in any of the how many areas are there, Johnny? Because it looks like there's maybe four or five, three around
I
there.
I think there's actually seven, maybe, but they're all pretty big.
Yeah, like there's, because you can actually, you can choose. I think to get to any one of the endings, I think you only have to go through maybe about three or four. That's what it seems
right,
like.
Right, but there's a lot of replay value because
yeah.
you can go through entirely different levels to get different endings.
Yeah, and I mean, there's at least a couple of bosses in every one of these big areas.
And the bosses are awesome, too.
Yeah, the bosses are completely amazing. They're huge. And, you know, I really, what one of the things I find endearing about it is its art style, it seems kind of... It's a little bit crude, but that almost makes it endearing.
Yeah.
It has that kind of like, I don't know, I guess you could say it got that handcrafted feel to it, which is sounds...
It's really colorful.
Yeah.
For such a gory game, you know, it really violent game. It's very colorful, almost garish.
Yeah. It's really, really good. I mean, if you like Contra, you definitely have to check it out. I finally had a chance to kind of go through all the characters and stuff. And there were even some of the guns I thought I wouldn't like the first guy, what is his name? Xerxes something or other with the, the jet engine gun.
He carries around a freaking jet engine.
Yeah. And you know, it's, and what, I mean, what it lets you do is it just lets you kind of paint the area. Like you just hold down the button and it's just like a constant sort of stream of death to anything you have to come up with.
You can also use it to hover a little bit.
Can you? I was wondering about that.
Yeah, if you point it downwards and use the modifier to, like, kick it up a notch, it'll actually lift you up a bit.
Okay.
Which is very Cave Story, in fact.
But, yeah, I mean, it's generally all of the guns are great across the board. I mean, the thing is, they're really, really crazy. I mean, what really amazes me about it is it's just very creative, and a lot of the concepts in it are really... I mean, much like Shoot One Up, the same thing where it takes a very basic concept or a concept that's been done to death and does some really, really crazy things. I mean, all of the guns, I mean, there's a giant chainsaw gun. And
but it's a chainsaw made of energy.
Yeah, it's a plasma chainsaw.
Yeah.
And so you can just walk around and, I mean, you just hold your chainsaw out and you just buzzsaw everything. But and then
actually,
also,
my favorite guy, I think, is the one with the little orbs that kind of... you know, they float around him, and when you push the button, the orbs shoot out lasers in the direction that you tell it to.
Yeah.
And it's a very imprecise thing. It's actually a bit like Shoot One Up, where you're not exactly sure where you're going to shoot. You just know it's in over there. And then once it gets going, you can kind of, tweak it a little bit until it's pointing right at the enemy that you want it to do.
Yep.
But it's really powerful, but it's a little bit harder to control. I think that is really awesome, that character.
Yeah, and what's cool is that different guns are really effective against different bosses, and then, you know, some guns simply aren't. But the thing is, but you know, it's not just like other games where, you know, a gun is a gun is a gun is a gun, really. You know, like, you know, unless you get maybe like I know in the old Contra, like spread is kind of the really good one to get, but
yeah, right.
In this case, it's like there's a lot more tailoring towards, you know, this boss is really kind of weak against this gun. And which is impressive,
really,
when
there
there's
is
so many
no,
different...
There's no regular gun in Weapon of Choice.
Not really.
I mean, the main character uses a jet engine. Like, that's the default.
Yeah, and now you can switch back to a normal gun, but it's not nearly as effective.
Yeah, I don't know why you would. That's a strange option to even have in there.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's what I started to do at first, because I was like, oh man, these guns are so weird, and just the way they shoot and everything, and... But, I mean, you learn after a while that, you know, once you get used to these special guns, they're a lot better, and a lot of them are really, really fun. I also like the fact that you can, if one of your characters dies, you have, I think there's about six characters that you have to choose from in total. And what you can do is you can bring in the next character, you can just choose, you know, of kind of the pool of characters. Usually, I think you start out with three, but you can, as the game goes on, you can pick up more. But you can actually rescue your character that just died and pick that character up and take that character to the boss. And if you beat the boss while you're carrying that character, you get a free life. So yeah, they does a lot of inventive stuff. I mean, and I can see after playing at PAX, after playing a grapple buggy, kind of has the same feel of it, at least with the backpack, the spider backpack that you wear, where you can climb on walls and stuff, has kind of that same feel. So I can see how, you know, Weapon of Choice kind of bleeds over into, you know, grapple buggy. But yeah, definitely. I mean, it's
$3.
Yeah, it's like $200 and something points. And it's just, I mean, it's so good. I mean, and has more than one ending. You can, you know, you can kind of fight through, you can help the humans or help the aliens, and it's just really,
it
really
also,
good.
Actually, if you like Brutal Legend, I think you'll like Weapon of Choice a lot because it has this totally over-the-top Lords of Thunder soundtrack.
It does.
I mean, the music is like super cheesy heavy metal, like late 70s heavy metal stuff. Mm-hmm. It's great.
And there's also some really funny text when you start an area. A lot of talk about sheep. And, you know, kind of like historical facts, like it's set in this, you know, alternate history where apparently in like the year 2178, sheep became as smart as humans and started to take over the world.
Really? I missed that.
Yeah, next time you play, just read read some of the text that's in there because it's really, really funny. So I highly recommend it. I mean, for like $3, it's a steal.
I'm so glad you like it.
That's great.
I would encourage everybody to check out these games. And there's a free, I mean, it's an Xbox indie game, so there's a pretty extensive free trial. So if you're not sure that you want to spend $3 on this highly recommended game, you can try it for yourself.
Yeah, I found that it was actually pretty hard to find on Xbox Live. It was buried.
Yeah, that whole marketplace is crap. Mm-hmm. It might actually be easier to find it if you go to their website, to the Xbox website, and go to the marketplace there and just do a search for it.
Yep.
And then you can actually click a button to download it or even buy it from your computer. Yep. And then when you turn on your Xbox, it just starts downloading. So.
Integration.
All right. Well, anyway, that's going to be the end of New Business. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, your listener mail. We're catching up, folks. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week on Nintendo World Report, we've got final coverage, I think final, right, John, of PAX East 2010. and this is a lot of fun, actually. There's a video of John Lindemann versus Insano Lord from our forums playing NHL 94, the director against the detractor. See Lindy put his Canadian heritage on the line in the ultimate hockey showdown with an NWR forum reader.
Yeah, with a very controversial ending, I might add. Still,
yes.
That is my contribution to the video.
Yep.
And Neo reviews Rage of the Gladiator, which he says is like Punch-Out with good graphics, but gladiators. And the controls aren't as good as Nintendo's, but it's got gladiators, so.
Punch-Out without good controls is worrisome.
All right, in our obscure review of the week, Pedro looks at Grill Off with Ultra Hand. This is a Club Nintendo reward title in which you grab meat off of a grill.
Oh, yeah.
You grab meat off of a grill when it's done just right.
And
it is more like a novel piece of Nintendo memorabilia than a real game. And Ultra Hand is apparently a really, really old school Nintendo toy that was one of those kind of extending hands that you could grab stuff with.
I'm sure Kohler has four in his apartment.
Yeah. They were made for use at the Love Hotels.
Is it possible to play the Ella Conga with these Ultra Hands?
Oh, I bet you can.
But I do think that Grill Off with Ultra Hand is essentially just innuendo game 2010.
I don't know no other way to grill. You know what I'm saying?
You and me both, Johnny.
Neil, Zach, and Matt Blunden provide us the Best of DSiWare's First Year feature, where they give us a guided tour of the finest games that DSiWare has to offer to date, with over 25 games featured.
Yeah.
Many over 25, actually.
there's a lot of stuff on there, but, I mean, this is a big feature. This is like the one-year anniversary of DSiWare, and I was just reading through there, and you guys know I don't have a DSi, but like reading through there, I found at least like half a dozen, if not more, games that I really want to play. Not going to make me go buy a DSi, but awesome feature. Original content. That's what Nintendo World Report is all about. Go check it out right now. Okay. Okay, now we're back for listener mail. These are people who wrote in to rfn at nintendoworldreport.com, mostly before PAX, so we do have a little ways to catch up here, but I'm excited to present you with a quartet of emails this week, and James has the first one.
David O. from Lake Arrowhead, California, a.k.a. Hero of Time 113, writes, in your years at NWR, what has been your favorite experience meeting or interviewing a big name in the industry?
Who wants to go first?
I don't know if I've actually met any big names, really. Certainly not like...
Evan.
Johnny certainly has. I mean, outside Evan. Of outside of the people on this podcast, I mean...
Yeah.
John, you've done interviews at E3s and stuff.
I mean, technically, John, you do have the biggest name I've met, so...
I'm just trying to think, because it's been so long since I've actually been to E3, because, I mean, I didn't go last year. The last one I went to, I believe, was 2006.
Yeah. And you don't go out to a lot of junkets and stuff.
No, that's the thing. I mean, I do more coordination of sending people to junkets than actually going out to them.
Don't get your hands dirty, eh, John?
Well, that's the thing. I can't. Unfortunately, I'm not in New York or L.A., so...
Yeah, they're all either in New York, L.A., or San Francisco.
Yeah.
I mean, or I guess in some cases they used to be in Seattle, but they're not really anymore. Or Redmond,
I guess the biggest brush with fame that I've ever had kind of as a result of doing this is when I sat two people down from Stan Lee. And that was at E3 2006,
oh, yeah.
Which that was wild because we were in one of the theater booths for
Marvel Ultimate Alliance.
And it was so funny because, you know, a couple of his handlers, I guess, walked in and they came in right at the end just before they started to play it. And I was one of the last people in and they were seeing them from back to front. And so I was up in the front and damn, to freaking Stan Lee and walk right in and sit like his you know, probably handler or whatever, I don't know, sat beside me, and then he was right next to me. It was really weird. And I'm like, holy shit, that's Stan Lee, you know?
Yeah, dude.
I mean, he's just, like, a really random, I mean, he's not even, like, it's just a really random person to be around, you know, since he doesn't come out that much either.
He was taping another cameo for one of those Marvel films that he makes in every single one of them.
I was like, hey, you're the cab driver from...
You're bystander number 3 in Spider-Man 3. Or he's bystander number 4 in Spider-Man 2.
I think we'll save Johnny for last because he's clearly going to one-up the lot of us.
Yeah.
But the best I have is that at E3, I did briefly... say about 3 words to I guess he's in charge of EA sports division now.
Peter Moore?
Yeah, over in the EA booth. And before that, I believe it was Iwata that walked through the Nintendo booth behind me that Aaron pointed out about 30 seconds after he left. He goes, oh, there's Iwata. I'm like, really? Oh, he came by about 10 seconds ago. I'm like, thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, I've had that experience with Miyamoto, where we've been over in the Nintendo booth and he's like walked right by me kind of thing.
Well, I've met most of my heroes in the game industry. You know, I'm not going to talk about that. A lot of times it was just like a quick handshake. It was only memorable because of my idolatry of them, you know. It's not like we had a deep conversation most of the time. In terms of like random conversations, I think of the time that I was visiting Nintendo of America headquarters. I think we were playing Metroid Prime 2 or the DS, one of those years. But I was up there, and we had a fire alarm in the building at NOA headquarters. And so we all had to go out to the parking lot. And I'm talking every Nintendo of America employee is out there. So Reggie had come in that morning and had shown us a commercial for DS or something and, you know, had talked up some marketing crap and told us sales numbers and stuff. But he wasn't really doing a lot of interviews, even though all the press was there. And, of course, even if he was, we wouldn't get an interview. We've never interviewed Reggie. We've asked 100 times. But we're all in the parking lot just kind of hanging around, and, you know, Reggie's there. And so people just start to kind of coalesce around him, of course, because he can't get away. We're just all waiting to get let back in the building. And so we ended up having like this weird group interview almost of Reggie out in the parking lot during the fire alarm. And, you know, I don't remember what I asked him. I probably asked him one question. But, you know, just like being there and standing around talking to him. And, I mean, you know, if it was a different person, we probably would have just been casually talking, but Reggie's so sought after for comments, because he always makes these, you know, kind of inflammatory comments about the competition or what Nintendo is or isn't worried about. And so people were really eager to hear what he had to say, and so people basically were just interviewing him out in the parking lot. It's their only chance.
He's the closest thing Nintendo has to, like, the Sony executive proclamations, but he's not quite as... I don't know, I guess nobody wants to call him out on his bullshit quite as much as they do them, because it's...
It's not as much bullshit with Reggie because they're the most successful.
It's true, but...
Yeah.
That's the thing.
I think but even during the not-so-great times there, I think it just kind of the force of personality that he projects as
character. Would have been probably within a few months of when he came out at E3 and said, "My name's Reggie, I'm about kicking ass and taking..."
Yes, that is exactly the moment where...
"And I'm about making Wii music."
He was quite a personality.
Yeah.
I was like, who on earth is this?
I think I probably literally did a double take when he did that at E3. I mean, we were in the audience, and I just normally tune... You know, when guys like Iwata come out, I usually just kind of tune it out.
The thing is, that was the year after 2003, the Pac-Man thing.
What are
they going to do to kind of distance themselves from last year? And it's like, oh my God, they're going to beat us up? Like, is that it?
So who didn't like Pac-Man Versus, just out of curiosity?
Everybody turn to your right and punch the person beside you.
Or you will be killed.
Well, Johnny and I, you and I also, we talked to... Tetris, Hank Rogers. Remember that?
Hank Rogers, yeah. Yeah, that was when we kind of randomly met him at E3, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was really cool. He was really cool to talk to, too.
He's a really old school kind of industry vet. He's not that famous, although he should be. Mm-hmm. And so I knew about him because I read Game Over, the book, you know?
Yeah.
And so I recognized his name. I was like, is that the guy? Well, yeah, of course it is. How many people do you know named Hank? So I went up and introduced myself, and that was awesome. And again, it was kind of just a casual meeting, so we didn't really get into any kind of nitty gritty. I think I mentioned baseball to him or something, but
yeah.
actually, one of my favorite interviews that I've gotten to do was just last year at E3. Neil and I went to this hotel like a couple blocks away from the LA Convention Center and got to interview not only Hank Rogers, but Alexei Pajitnov.
That's pretty cool.
I was wondering when you're going to bring him up.
That was pretty incredible. And you know, I got to go up and introduce myself in Russian to Alexei Pajitnov and talk with him on a pretty detailed level about, like, basically the game design of Tetris for about 30 minutes, which was some sick shit. Like, I wish we had gotten a really good audio recording of it. Unfortunately, we had a crappy recorder. I mean, it was good enough for Neil to eventually do a transcript of it, but it wasn't good enough to post the audio. But it was so fascinating talking to those guys about a game that really hasn't changed much in 20, 25 years, Tetris. Mm-hmm. But, you know, arguably one of the most important games ever made, and a very deep game for, you know, considering its simplicity. So it was really fun to get into the nitty gritty design. And I love doing that. I love talking to people who actually know what they're talking about. Because you can ask them things that will catch them off guard, but that they are totally comfortable talking about. It's like, I love the look in someone's eyes when you ask the best question they've heard all day.
Yeah.
You know, when you don't repeat the same shit that everybody says. And they're like, oh, I get to actually think before I answer this one. Awesome.
Well, the thing is, at E3 too, you get so many marketing people that are just going to read you a script.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Token
you get
points.
So tired of talking to them.
I was going to say, one of the worst interviews I've ever had was with Charlie Chibata of NOA. Now, to be fair, he had only been in that job for like a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was kind of replacing Beth Llewellyn, I think. It was right when Nintendo had moved some of their operations down to San Francisco and LA and New York for that matter. But that was the first year that we saw Cammy and all that. That might have been in 2006 actually. I don't remember. 08 maybe, I think. But anyway, Charlie Chibata, he seems like a nice guy, but holy shit, that was a complete waste of time. It was like talking to a brick wall. I mean, at least with Perrin, and I've interviewed Perrin Kaplan, and at least she's totally charming and funny, and she's very sly about how she's not telling you jack shit.
Yeah.
You know? Like, at least it's, she does it in kind of an entertaining way, and Charlie was just like, well, I don't know, or well, I can't talk about that. It was just really lame. And in general, interviewing Nintendo execs is a complete waste of your time. Now, the developers are different. One of my favorite interviews that I've done, certainly with anyone from Nintendo especially, is was Kensuke Tanabe. And I got to speak with him, well, a couple of times. The one I'm really remembering was for Metroid Prime 2. So this would have been back in 2004. And I had watched the video that they had running. I had played the demo, which was actually, it wasn't playable that E3, I'm pretty sure. It wasn't playable until the media summit that fall. But they had a video of it running, like the attract mode. And I had taken a bunch of notes from that. I had captured a video of it that we put on the site. And so I went in there, and I, you know, I'm a big Metroid fan, as you know. So I went in there armed with all kinds of stuff to ask him. The interesting thing about that interview was that IGN was in there too. So I was basically, it was Dan Bloodworth and I sitting next to Matt Casamassina. And Dan's a quiet guy. He didn't ask too many questions. He was taking a lot of notes, and I was asking most of the questions. And then Matt was asking some questions, but Matt's questions were mostly like, I don't know, I felt kind of lame stuff, like, is it going to be 60 frames per second? You know, like the stuff that he really obsesses over, all the little technical details. I was like, are you doing Screw Attack? And, you know, he says yes. And I'm like, how do you do that in 3D? Can you use it as a weapon? He's like, well, I haven't really thought about it, but I guess you could use it as a weapon, yes. And I was like, okay, that's how I will play the game. So yada, yada, yada. And I just, you know, I just got into all these design things and asking about these different features and how are you going to translate this from 2D to 3D and how is it different from the one before it? And he was just surprisingly open about the game considering how little they'd shown about it at the time. And in general, I've always felt that talking with people from Retro Studios, they've been unusually open about their games when I talked to them. Because we did an interview, I don't remember who was there with me, but we did an interview for Corruption back in 2006. And at the time, it was supposed to be a Wii launch game. Of course, it got delayed pretty significantly not too long after that. But at the time, they were preparing for launch, and we asked them some, you know, some pretty serious questions about multiplayer and about Wii controls and about graphics because, you know, the game didn't look that much different from the GameCube titles, so we were kind of curious about that. That was actually an area where they improved a lot during the delay. But Brian Walker, the American producer there, and then Mark Pacini, who is one of the guys who, he was the director of the three Prime games, and then he left Retro to go form his own company with some other people.
Yeah.
And they have not announced their first game yet. But I've always felt like talking with Retro Studio guys, whether it's during a formal interview or off the record at a Nintendo party or whatever, those guys are awesome to talk to because they think about Metroid in the same ways that I do. I mean, and far beyond it, of course. But there aren't that many people I can talk to about Metroid who can actually talk back to me, and we can have like a debate or a real conversation about it. And those guys obviously can because they're married to it, or they were. So it was pretty awesome talking to those guys and just getting super nerdy on Metroid.
I'm surprised you haven't mentioned being able to play with Igarashi's whip yet, Johnny.
Yeah, that was a photo op. I mean, that was separate. We did interview Igarashi that year, but unfortunately, he was mostly talking about Castlevania Judgment.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked to him about Rondo of Blood and the DS games, and would you like to do a 2D Castlevania on WiiWare?
I'm sure he got a lot of that, actually.
Oh, yeah. He did, yeah, because nobody wanted to talk about Judgment. It was
we know this game is shit. Let's just talk about your other cool game.
Actually, I would have liked to have talked about Judgment, but nothing the PR rep would have let him
answer. Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, so I mean, we did ask him some things about Judgment, but it was pretty weak.
So, Ego, would you classify this as career suicide, or is it just kind of a joke? Is it just kind of a lark?
Are we being trolled?
Are you pulling a suit of 51 on us?
Are you friends with Mr. Kojima?
Yeah. So Iga is a lot of fun to interview, and he is such a big personality. But that interview itself, I mean, the content of the interview wasn't that great. The only other one I'll mention, obviously, I'm hogging this question, but I think I do have the most interview experience out of the four of us.
Really?
You've certainly got more than my one.
Yeah. Okay. So when you go to E3 9 times, you meet and talk to a lot of developers, but the Takahashi brothers from Camelot, we interviewed them about Mario Tennis for GameCube, I think, and didn't really talk about Mario Tennis that much, as you might imagine. There wasn't that much to talk about.
It's tennis with Mario.
So
the end.
We talked about a lot of other stuff. I think I might have even asked them about Wario's, like, quasi-racial slur in Mario Golf 64. We definitely talked a lot about Golden Sun and, you know, them doing console RPGs and stuff like that, them working for other platforms. And the most fun about that was not so much the content, but just the style of the interview, because obviously, you know, we had a translator in the room with the Takahashi brothers, but you almost didn't need the translator. And I don't speak a lick of Japanese. I know like three words, but these guys were so animated in their facial expressions, their hand motions, the topics that they were talking about. They were so into the games that they make that I could just watch them and listen to them, and it felt like I could pretty much understand what they were saying before the translator even started. And that was a strange, very strange feeling. And I just felt like a real affinity to those guys. And I'm not really a Camelot fanboy. I'm not that big a fan of their games, but I'm a big fan of those guys, the Takahashi brothers. I think they're really cool guys. And so I'm always going to be interested in what they do, because you can really feel their passion for what they do when you talk to them. So that's the last one I'll mention. There's a lot more I could go into someday, but those are some of my favorites for sure. Okay, so Jamie, a.k.a. Pogue Squadron, what a great name, writes, "Many times a game is released on the Wii that does not use motion control or does not use motion effectively. Monster Hunter 3 is the latest example of a big game that doesn't use motion but is still exclusive to the Wii. I often ask myself, what then is the point of releasing this game on the Wii? In most cases, it boils down to the Wii's massive user base and lower cost of development. The upcoming NBA Jam is a game that fits this profile perfectly. A game that seemingly puts little to no emphasis on motion, yet is billed as a Wii exclusive. It is very hard for me to get excited for these Wii exclusive games when it's obvious that they would be better suited on another console. As game reviewers, journalists, and fans of gaming, how do you approach retail Wii games that do not have compelling use of motion?"
Well, I would hate to have a game just use it just for the sake of using it, which is what we saw too much in the Wii's early days. Mm-hmm. Disaster Dave Crisis, anybody?
Well, yeah, and you know, we saw that on the DS too.
Yeah, the DS parallel is very clear, and I mean, how many DS games could there be that would be quote unquote better, you know, where the touchscreen or dual screen functionality is kind of trivial on PSP? Mm-hmm. But I don't care.
Yeah,
you know, I'll just bite the. I'm not like, oh well, in an ideal world, this game would be on PSP and it would be better, so I won't buy it. You know, I mean, what? No way. I mean, if it's a good game, I'm buying it.
Yeah.
You know, whether it could be better in some hypothetical other platform is irrelevant to me.
I think in the case of NBA Jam, which is the specific incident we're referencing here, I'm not sure that it will be made appreciably that much better on an HD console, because the graphics aren't supposed to look good.
Yeah, it's very arcadey. It's very arcadey both in looks and gameplay anyways. So.
Well, I mean, yeah. The games intentionally look bad. I mean, they only have 3 frames of animation on the faces. That's it. There are 3.
But it's kind of in this style of being comedic.
Yeah, it's going for that kitsch factor.
Yeah,
basically. I mean,
even when that was all the systems were basically capable of, they intentionally made it look kind of crappy because it was funnier that way.
See, I would say that without the Wii, NBA Jam wouldn't get made.
Yeah,
that's
the point, isn't it? I mean, I think with quite a few games, I think when we've talked before about 2D games, you know, Boy in His Blob and all this stuff, it's like, well, yeah, you use traditional controls. Yeah, you know, hypothetically, you could have that game on the HD consoles. You know, you don't need motion controls to make it work. But the development cost environment and the user base of the Wii makes these 2D retail games possible. So just because, you know, there isn't anything sort of direct, it doesn't mean that it isn't a kind of unique opportunity on Wii.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, is Retro Game Challenge going to get made for Xbox or PS3? No. Yeah, again, it doesn't really use the touchscreen or any of
it. But it could be made for the PSP, though.
I mean, these Retro Game Challenge has got, you know, deliberately basic graphics.
Right.
It's not the best example, but you could reference plenty of examples. Like, you know, say, for instance, Order of Ecclesia, yeah, Castlevania. It's nice having the map on the other screen, but if this were on PSP, it would have vastly better graphics, so I can't really get excited about it. Well, that there's not a consideration for me. Mm-hmm. If it's quality piece of software in a genre that I want to play, and it happens to be on DS, then I'm all for it. And it's exactly the same with the Wii. I mean, you could say with Monster Hunter, yes, it would look better on the HD consoles or whatever it is, but, you know, I mean, it certainly looks very nice on Wii in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've no aversion to plugging a classic controller in and playing something in that style if it's a good game that I want to play.
Well, the thing is, in the case of Monster Hunter Tri, they actually had a very good reason why. And the thing is, you can also use a Wii Remote Nunchuck, by the way.
Yeah, there's plenty of different control options, but obviously it's not integral to the experience.
Well, the thing is, they looked at it and they said, well, people are going to be sitting there with a sword hacking away at monsters for hours and hours. They're not going to want to use a Wii Remote to sit there for hours and hours hacking away with a sword. So that's actually why they added the support for the classic controller.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would be far more worried about what John said about, you know, crowbarring in motion controls because you think you have to.
Oh, we've seen plenty of that.
Yep.
And we have seen plenty of that. Yeah. And with the DS in the early days, the touchscreen and the microphone blowing and all that nonsense.
Yeah, we've seen good games really ruined by developers' desire to pander to the features.
Yeah,
what they
think is expected or required, yeah, or, you know, and all this, yeah, sort of stuff. And I just, it certainly, as a platform matures, you find that happens less and less. And it's just a case of, well, it may be, you know, many different reasons why a developer feels that it's the right fit on a certain system. It might be the very specific technical aspects of, you know, processing power or development costs or the interface, or it might be things like demographics, market, or the developer's experience with working on that platform before. There's all sorts of reasons for that. But at the end of the day, what matters to me as a consumer is just the end experience worth playing.
This, as you said, there's a parallel here with DS, and actually in November of 2004, the DS was scarcely a month old, and I wrote an editorial about basically the same phenomenon happening on DS, where people were complaining that some of the games didn't really use the touchscreen, some of them used it too much, etc. And let me quote just a couple of sentences here from the conclusion, because I think they really apply especially to Wii. By the way, the editorial is called Feature Hungry, if you want to go read the whole thing. Quote, "Did it bother us when Nintendo released Metroid Prime, a game that doesn't use any of the GameCube's unique hardware features and, truth be told, probably could have been pulled off on Xbox or the PC? No, we don't care that it could have been released on another system. We are satisfied that it is being released on Nintendo's system." End quote. I think the same thing really applies. It's just a kind of an eternal thing, is that, you know, if good games are getting released on a platform that you own, why are you bitching about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could see the issue more broadly in terms of, you know, on the whole, you want to see games that do take advantage of the Wii's features.
Mm-hmm.
In general, you want to see that. You know, if every game were like Monster Hunter.
Oh, sure. Well, that's hardly a realistic concern, though.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the point. You've got the Boom Bloxes. You've got the Wii Sports Resorts. You've got, you know, yeah, I feel like there's very much a place for the Muramasas, the Boy and His Blobs, the Monster Hunter Tries alongside them, as long as there isn't a predominance, a real unbalancing of one over the other, then there's no problem.
It's a big marketplace, and the nice thing is, the more, you know, the larger the user base is, the more systems Nintendo sells, the bigger the tent gets, and really the more room there should be for these things to coexist.
Yeah.
And hey, look, I mean, to Pogue Squadron, I would say, if you're not interested in Monster Hunter, that's okay. It doesn't need to be because it doesn't use motion control. There's a lot of reasons that someone might not be interested in it, and that's fine. Go find something else that you are interested
in. And you'll probably find out all of them by playing the demo. Probably.
Yeah. Yeah, the demo should give you a very clear idea of what to expect.
On the issue of Monster Hunter, the thing that's really killing Monster Hunter for me isn't the demo, because I've played it, but it's region-restricted online play.
Yeah, I'm really surprised at that.
That's major ball dropping.
I understand why, though, because don't you have to pay to play it in Japan?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we speak to is only...
Could they
only
not open it up for Europe and America, though? Because basically that's pretty much killing the game for me. Because the only chance I would have of getting value out of that is playing it with people from the site.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are in North America.
Yes.
It's just that, to me, is a big issue, you know? And it's not something that you get on the other platforms, as far as I'm aware, is that kind of region restrictions on online.
It's true,
play.
Yeah. Generally, you can play online versus other regions.
Whereas there's a number of Nintendo online games, Endless Ocean, Mario Strikers Charged, that suffer from this problem that don't have any kind of extenuating circumstances in terms of Japan having a different pay structure or anything. So,
yeah, newsflash, Nintendo's online service sucks.
Yes, but this is a facet of it that is not discussed very often because North America's in there, the world.
Yeah, but I mean, is there any way you could get around it, Greg? Like if you bought like a US Wii, you bought a US copy of the game and all that junk?
If you spend $300.
Probably.
Like, yeah.
No, that probably would work. I doubt it's tracing your IP or anything like that to see where you are.
Well, no, because I've got a Japanese Wii. That, you know, and you could, you know, like with a Wii Shop channel on that, that's not a problem. But yeah. That's if you had the other Wii, it'd be all right. But I already have two. I don't want the complete set. I'm not going to get the Korean one. And
complete the set. Get the IQ Wii when it comes out. Yeah. There you go.
Okay, well, Greg has the next question.
Chris from Chicago writes, I just wanted to give a shout out to a handheld treasure that was overlooked by a lot of gamers at the end of 2009. I'm talking about Might and Magic Clash of Heroes, a puzzle-based RPG developed by Capybara and published by Ubisoft for the DS. I'm not typically a fan of Ubisoft games, and the box art looks like something from Atlus. But if you could get past those two strikes against it...
What?
This game is a real gem. It's a variation on the classic Match 3 puzzle genre. You manipulate the units on the bottom screen, and the top screen is populated by the units of your opponent. When you match three units of the same type and colour, they charge up and are sent to the top screen to attack after a few turns. Think Meteos, but turn-based. The gameplay is very addicting, the sprite-based graphics are beautiful, and the story, while not great, is good enough to keep you invested in the characters. I got this game along with Spirit Tracks at Christmas, and I beat it three times before I even booted up Zelda, which is my favourite franchise. I have heard nothing but good things about this game.
Yeah, me too.
Right. It sounds kind of like the new Puzzle Quest.
It's very much in the Puzzle Quest mold, as I understand it. I know Edge gave it a very, very complimentary review. It got a 9, which is very difficult to get in that magazine.
Yeah, because they kill everything.
Or very easy to get in that magazine.
Well, very easy to get if you dare to bore you with No More Heroes. But it's really well reviewed. I've been considering getting it, but it's just like it would take me so long to be done with Pokemon. I'm not rushing, but it sounds really, really cool. I mean, Might and Magic is some old RPG kind of license from years and years ago that Ubisoft just picked.
Excuse me? It's actually a very big franchise.
But Ubisoft has picked up the license and is kind of rebooting it now.
Didn't 3DO make Might and Magic for a while?
It was a 3DO-owned property.
Yeah. Ubisoft's picked it up and it's got this... Like what he's talking about with the Atlus game bit, it's kind of got this anime-ish art style, which you wouldn't expect to see with something called Might and Magic, or I wouldn't, at least. So it's a little bit of a weird kind of hodgepodge, and obviously the type of game and the storyline and stuff hasn't got much to do with anything you've ever seen from Might and Magic before. So it's this very bizarre kind of coincidence of factors, but the fact is apparently the game is really, really good. And very sort of complicated, apparently. You know, like pretty much every review I've read of it, as it says, well, we can't really explain everything to you here, but it's basically like this. You know, like they kind of have to skirt over all the little intricacies of it.
Isn't Might and Magic related to Dungeons and Dragons, or is it just
no? It's
kind
not.
Of like
started
imitation
off as a PC game way back in the day.
It's one of those like. Initial four early computer role-playing games, like Bard's Tale,
Wizardry.
Ultima, and the Wizardry series.
If I remember correctly, it was originally created by a now-defunct company called New World Computing.
Oh!
And that's going way, way back.
Funded by Terrence Malick.
And then they became part of 3DO, and then 3DO became crap.
Yep.
Oh, it's good the series didn't die, apparently. Somebody's doing
something
good with it.
There have been, like, 9 games in the mainline numbered series in that franchise.
Yeah.
And there were tons of spinoffs, right? Heroes of Might and Magic and blah, 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 blah.
Like, just recently we had, like, Dark Messiah of Might and Magic.
Cool. I will keep an eye out for it. Certainly. It sounds good. It sounds like it's going to be a game that will be really expensive within a few more months.
I think there's going to be a downloadable version for XBLA and PSN.
Oh, smart.
Ew, really? But the thing is, I mean, this does sound like it would be very well suited to a portable.
Yeah. Well, you know,
like Puzzle Quest.
He says, how did he put it? The box art looks like it was made by Atlas. Well, yeah. you can tell it wasn't because there's more than one copy on the store shelf.
Heyo.
Yeah.
Or on the flip side, because there is a copy on the store shelf.
But it is strange that with it Ubisoft, and they're kind of trying to relaunch this brand that has some name recognition, that they didn't seem to push it that hard. For instance, I don't think we got a review copy of this.
No, we didn't.
To be honest, it seemed to be, when I've read reviews of it, there seem to be a few outlets that either didn't get review copies or just skipped reviewing it or whatever. I mean, I don't understand that really with a big publisher like Ubisoft.
I think Ubisoft itself is just big, and games get lost inside its own
certain
tubes.
Games just don't get the same treatment as others.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever work with their PR, you realize that's a big publisher, and
I mean, I know
it can be confusing.
I know EA as a company subdivides itself for PR purposes. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's even worse.
Yeah, in a way, it's worse, but at least they can focus on more of their games because all right, I'm only managing EA Sports.
Right, they would have to, right? I mean, there's a person at EA who only does PR for Madden.
Oh yeah, probably.
And that itself, I'm sure, is a big job.
Yeah. It's probably multiple people now. I mean, there's the ESPN TV show. Oh yeah,
may well be. So before we move on, I do want to say we haven't talked about it on the show, but John and I saw a demo of Puzzle Quest 2 at PAX.
Hey, I was there. Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Yeah.
John and I were like on camera, or John was holding the camera, and we were there. But yeah, James, you were behind.
Yes.
That guy talked forever. I don't know when that
told John we literally have to write nothing about that game because he said everything that could ever possibly be said about it.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason why that video isn't up yet is because it's 20 minutes, and I'm gonna have to chop it.
He showed us every feature you could imagine, and I asked him a lot of questions. I played a ton of Puzzle Quest. I probably played over 100 hours of the DS Puzzle Quest, and I played Galactrix too before I traded it back in because it wasn't very good. So this is Puzzle Quest 2 now. It's coming out on DS and XBLA and potentially other platforms after that. There was a Wii version of the first Puzzle Quest, which is ass. I mean, looks like a bad Flash game and runs even worse.
Yeah, the running stuff is terrible. I can't believe how that's true, that it can't even run properly on that.
Well, it's because they just literally port the code. I mean, it's almost running inside of a box of something else.
It's almost emulated. The best questions that Johnny asked were basically stealth versions of the question of, so is this game not going to suck like Galactrix?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. I came out and said, like, is it going to actually run on DS this time? Because as much as I played Puzzle Quest on DS, you'll get no argument from me that is a janky-ass game. I mean, it really is kind of a mess, technically. It's a tribute to how good the gameplay is that anybody played it. Because it's a fucking mess. It really is.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, we've completely rebuilt the engine for DS. We focused on speed optimization. We want everything to flow better. We've really cut down on particle effects and things. They basically design it so that after you make a match, the screen will refill with gems as fast as possible. I was like, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean, in the first one, the music didn't even loop right. It was really ridiculous. But they've also done some nice things with the interface. So they've actually swapped around where things are positioned on the screen so that the gems can actually be shown bigger so that they're easier to select the one you want. Cause there have been problems in the past with accidentally selecting the wrong gem and stuff like that. So they've actually like minimized some of the stuff off to the side. They've kind of made that more efficient so that they can take up most of the screen on the DS with the game board. And that's nice. It's really good. I was pretty impressed with the demo. I wish I had actually played it myself. We didn't really have time. So we just watched this guy play it while he talked about it, but it looks really good. I don't know, John, what you thought of it, but.
Well, yeah, I mean, it looked a lot better in the sense that they've kind of fleshed out. They're sort of an overworld now, little bit. Like, you can kind of, walk around on a town map and you encounter different characters and stuff and you talk to NPCs, so.
I think there's a kind of overworld light kind of going on in Might and Magic as well.
Cool.
These two games might be really very similar.
I think so, yeah, and that's cool. I'm really glad. I'm very supportive of the puzzle RPG genre because I think it's even stuff like Bookworm Adventures, which is barely an RPG. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really pretty stretching it.
It's got adventures in the title.
But what I really like about it is that I like puzzle games, but they do kind of feel arbitrary after a while. It just feels like they're getting harder for the sake of getting harder.
Yeah.
And I really like the idea that you can play a relatively simple puzzle game, but what you do in that game and what you get out of it affects the larger metagame. So yeah, I like the idea that there's something tying together these individual plays of the puzzle. And that's what Puzzle Quest did extremely well. Even Bookworm Adventures does it really well. And, you know, if that's what Clash of Might and Magic does, then I'm all over it. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really compelling mixture of genres, and especially when it's done well. And Galactrix, not done too well. It felt really, you know, Galactrix felt really bloated and too many damn mini games. It was too hard. The story actually was kind of cool, but everything else about it was like, oh, too much, just excessive. Like this episode. And John has the last email.
All right, the final email is Anonymous writes, is it me or are the releases for the Virtual Console just a random mishmash of games that some dude randomly picks from a hat? I have an idea. Why don't they pick one game from every system that is available and release it for the month? Promote the HE double hockey sticks out of it for the month, possibly focusing on a game a day or so, and see what happens. This randomness of garbage is getting out of control. Who is really in charge of this stuff anyway?
I want to insert this email came, what, probably a few weeks ago?
Yeah.
So this was before the day it all changed and we got Ogre Battle 64.
Yes.
But at that moment, this letter became completely invalid.
Ogre Battle 64 is a really interesting case, actually, because even it's come out in Europe as well, where it was never released originally.
Oh, did it really?
Nice.
Jeez.
I've got it.
Oh, nice.
I'm so glad people in Europe can play that. And
I haven't. I just watched the tutorial so far.
I'm glad that I've now dropped $70 to play that game.
The thing about it that's really interesting is that the publisher is listed as Square Enix, so it's the first third-party Nintendo 64 game, basically.
That's really screwy. So
it is, isn't it? Considering Nintendo published it in Japan, and then Atlas published it
in America.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing. Like, the Atlas logo still comes up on the European version, because it's just the North American version. But it's like, who is this company? What have they got to do with anything?
Well, see, and here's the screwy part, because, I mean, Square Enix came into it, obviously, because they purchased Quest, who developed the Ogre Battle games. This game, though, was different, because Nintendo basically funded this game's development, because they wanted RPGs on the N64.
Right. Well, and also Ogre Battle 64 used the largest Nintendo 64 cartridge.
Oh yeah, and
up to that point,
the most freaking expensive.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting. This is a game that has deep ties to Nintendo, like all the other N64 games. But it is not designated as a Nintendo published game on the Virtual Console itself on the Wii Shop channel. It says publisher Square Enix. So it's a kind of a landmark moment, funnily enough. I don't think this is going to open the door to Beetle Adventure Racing or whatever else that people might like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny. Like, the most niche game, the most niche third-party game is the one that comes out first, you know?
Well, not even that. It's like the most crazy licensing rights game is the one that comes out
first. Yeah, they actually resolved all this to get it done. I'm surprised.
Mean, it's like eight companies have a claim to this game in some way or another. It's completely insane.
But I think the point being, really, go back to the question, is who is really in charge of this stuff? Nintendo is in charge.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you could argue that every Virtual Console game is published by Nintendo.
Yeah, in a way.
Because ultimately, they're the gatekeeper, they're the distributor, they're taking their massive cut on all the sales.
Oh, yeah.
And they basically choose what goes out there. Same with WiiWare. I mean, you can submit a game to WiiWare, but Nintendo is going to decide whether it gets released or not, and when, and for how much.
They very much control the rate, the flow that was complained about in the question.
The pricing.
We've heard the stories about whether they basically killed Bionic Commando coming out and things like that, you know. So they are the gatekeepers. They are really ultimately in charge. I mean, obviously, we did a whole episode on this topic basically some months back, where we covered a lot of these sort of issues, the sort of exasperation with some of these problems and all that. But, you know, for all its faults, the Virtual Console is a tremendous, tremendous resource of all games.
Hey, with things like Ogre Battle 64 and Rondo of Blood now, too, I mean, it's actually been a pretty good few
weeks. Yeah, it's been a little bit of a renaissance just recently,
It seems to ebb and flow, the quality of Virtual Console.
Just when you think it's dead, it comes back from the dead.
I wonder if it's just dependent on what good WiiWare they have queued up. So if they don't have any big WiiWare, oh, shit, pull something out of the... out of the Virtual Console library.
Out of the virtual ass.
So, like, I can't think of any big WiiWare titles we got in the last couple weeks, so maybe it was like, all right.
Well, Cave Story was in between Rondo of Blood.
Yeah, so it got sandwiched
and
between the two. So, I mean,
There's so many peculiarities that you do have. I mean, for instance, you know, we've talked before about, you know, why is Pilot Wing 64 not on there? You know, launch N64 game.
Screw with us.
It seems so obvious. And Japan just got the original Pilot Wings, which is so weird because everywhere else has had it for ages. And, I mean, there's so many kind of vagaries and peculiarities associated with it. I can certainly understand the sentiment of the question that it's random and it's kind of arbitrary or, you know, silly. But it is going through a bit of a renaissance. I know you'll appreciate this, Johnny, is that in the Ogre Battle 64 was part of the most recent Hanabi Festival in Europe, where they have a string of import games. And one of them was Mylon Secret Castle.
Yeah,
for NES. Nice. Very nice. I would
be curious, you know, whose job it is, like, within the company. And I guess it's probably a regional position to determine, we're going to have these games come out this time.
Marketing,
the virtual
maybe?
Consoles are.
Certainly, what they have to choose from is limited by the emulator, by licensing rights, by a lot of other things that mainly come out of Japan for the most part.
I would love to just get to sit down with the people who make that determination.
Pick his brain. I know. It's probably someone at Treehouse, actually.
Because, I mean, as I said, look at the difference. Obviously, import games are a much bigger deal in Europe because we've got the games that we didn't get from North America as well as from Japan.
Import.
But there is that different approach in terms of, you know, going back to the question again, as he's saying about maybe spotlighting a certain platform or whatever. Well, the only thing that's vaguely analogous to that in any region, as far as I'm aware, is what they do in Europe with saying, here's a bunch of import games for this month that happens, you know, every 6 to 8 months or whatever. I mean, that's about as themed as it gets.
Yeah, I think it could be a very enlightening conversation to get to speak to someone who works in that particular division.
Yeah, the practicalities, because they don't talk about it very much.
No, I mean, I've never even seen any kind of mention of who does it.
Right. It's all very secretive, oddly. And I mean, it's Nintendo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so
that's
Nintendo.
How they work.
But it's particularly opaque, even for them.
I think we've evaded the spirit of the question a little bit, though, which is really about marketing. It's not so much about frustration with what's being released. It's, you know, there's all this great stuff on there, and instead of focusing on whatever weird, random game is being released this week, like Iron Eagle or whatever just came out on Neo Geo. So instead, I mean, obviously that's the focus, because the only time Nintendo ever mentions Virtual Console is in the context of, here's this game for TurboGrafx that's coming out this week. And it may be a game that really very, very, very few people care about. So I think it's more about, you know, shouldn't Nintendo do a better job of promoting the things that are already on there? I mean, there's like 400 games on Virtual Console.
Absolutely.
They never talk about them. And I agree. The only thing they do sometimes, actually, this is one of the few things Nintendo Channel or Nintendo Week, you know, the crappy show that they do on Nintendo Channel for North America, they actually do a nice job of promoting games on Virtual Console. If there's a new game coming out and there's something similar or related to it on Virtual Console, they'll show some video of that too and talk about it and tell you how much it costs. And it's not much, but I think it's actually really good, and I wish Nintendo would do a lot better about that.
It goes back to the whole thing we talked about earlier about the sort of deficiencies of the Wii Shop channel itself as well.
Yeah, it's really badly designed to
it
showcase
it needs to
anything.
Be better, you know, structured. And of course, one thing that they pretty much don't do, which other services do, is your sort of regular discounts and stuff. Like, the thing with PSN is that there's a lot of weeks where there's nothing worth chatting about that comes out, but they will amend the discounts. and that will keep you coming back to the shop, to the PSN shop.
Just to see what's on
just
sale.
To see, yep. You know, what got reduced this week. And then, you know, while you're browsing, you'll see ads essentially for like what else is on the service, and then maybe you end up buying something that isn't discounted, but, you know, it's kind of like a foot traffic effect, if you like.
Steam is brilliant.
What Johnny said with Geometry Wars 2, the fact that it's dropped down to $5 at that point.
That was during the break, but yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Yeah, Geometry Wars 2 is on
John.
Sale right now on Xbox. And
I just think the point being that, you know, the sales have beneficial effects beyond generating spikes in sales of the particular games that are discounted at that time. They make it more habitual for you to keep coming on to the shop and see what's there. But the problem, I mean, even given that, it wouldn't be that beneficial in the Wii Shop Channel's case if it were as sort of inaccessible and clunky as it is now. I mean, if you put it all together as part of a redesign where you did a much better job of presenting things clearly, of, you know, attracting people's attention with themes or spotlights, all this kind of stuff, and then you put that with a sort of regular kind of discount round, then you'd be on to something. But as it stands, I guess Nintendo, as we see with their retail games, has this sort of aversion to things coming down in price.
Yeah, it blows my mind, because you can just imagine Nintendo doing like a Virtual Console Game of the Week, something that's been out there for 2 or 3 years that maybe you didn't buy the first time around. And all they'd have to do is, you know, show a video of it on Nintendo Channel or whatever and say, we've dropped the price by 100 points, $1. And they're going to sell so many copies because of that. Because number one, they've put it out there and they've brought your attention to it. Number two, they've made it seem like a slightly better deal than you would have gotten before. And the thing is, they have nothing to lose. Because if they don't do that, that game, you're not going to download that game anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they drop the price from 800 points to 700, they're not losing 100 points. They're gaining 700 points per sale.
Well, the thing is, too, it's like there's a lot of, like, N64 games where would I like to have them? Yeah, I don't really need them. But, you know, the fact that they're $10, I don't really feel like spending $10 on a game that I'm probably not really going to play but wouldn't mind having in my collection. But if they drop it down to 800... I would definitely consider getting it. So,
So I think all these sorts of initiatives are things that, you know, could very much enhance the virtual console sort of reach, but they're obviously content with this more limited scope that it kind of occupies currently. I mean, the only thing I can think of was when Sega cut the price of their downloadable Sonic games across the platform. So I think that included Virtual Console and PS.
Really?
Yeah, I remember that. That was a couple of months ago, maybe?
Yeah. So that's pretty unique, actually, that he was even allowed to happen on the Wii Shop channel.
Well, I didn't even know that had happened. That's fascinating.
Evidently wasn't well publicized.
No, I mean, I stay on top of this stuff pretty well, and I had
Though, I mean, they did that, but was it on the front page of the Shop channel?
So there's hope. I mean, it has been done. They've broken the barrier.
Obviously, the initiative there was on Sega's side because it is a cross-platform thing. And that's the thing where I guess Nintendo tolerated that. I think things would be more different if they actually had that sort of initiative on their own part.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that opens the door for Hudson has dozens of games on Virtual Console. Square is building up quite a nice library, too. I mean, at least third parties have the potential to do this. I didn't even know that they did.
It is encouraging, yeah.
That's great. Well, there you go. I do think also, just very quickly, to say that part of the reason Nintendo doesn't do more discounting on Virtual Console and WiiWare is that they're still selling so many systems to new people.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people will boot up the shop channel and browse through there very clumsily and find things like Super Mario 3 that they want to buy. And I'm not saying Nintendo would ever discount Mario 3 because it's not really in their interest to do that.
No, certainly not.
But I just think that Nintendo, for the games that Nintendo really cares about selling on Virtual Console, they see consistent sales because for the same reason that Mario Kart DS continues to sell, you know, 5 years later.
Yeah, they're happy with that model. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, really what you're looking at is trying to craft the shop channel in such a way that those people that want to, that go there and look at it, you know, where they first set up their Wii, because it's, you know, you're just testing out all the things the system can do, and then you might download something incredibly well known like Super Mario Bros. 3. These sorts of things are really about trying to create retention of those people, keeping right. them interested in repeat business, as it were, and actually right. probing a little deeper into the recesses of it. And as it stands, the mechanisms for that are woefully underdeveloped.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly. I think we all agree. All right, well, that's going to be the end of our show. So before we go, let me mention a few things. First off, we love the emails. Thank you so much for sending those in, and please keep doing so. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please mention your name or whatever name you would like us to read on the air. Don't be anonymous like this last person was. We do like to hear your location. It's just fun to hear from people all over the world. So if you don't care, let us know. And make the questions interesting. I don't have to tell you that because they always are. So thank you very much. also want to mention our other podcast, of course, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. Greg is on the newest one. It's awesome. NWR Newscast. The upcoming episode will have Cave Story. They're doing a game club, which is like retroactive for WiiWare, basically. Yeah, they're doing Cave Story, which should be really exciting. I haven't talked about it much, but damn, that game is good. So play along with them and listen to that. You're going to enjoy it a lot. And finally, we have started up the poll for the next retroactive feature here on this very podcast. It is themed with Game Boy and Game Boy Color games, and I think this is probably the best, most consistently solid lineup we've had in a poll for retroactive. So I really encourage you to go check it out. Let me think if I can think of the games offhand. We've got Metroid 2, Return of Samus, Wario Land 3, Pokemon Pinball, Bionic Commando Elite Forces, and Metal Gear Solid, which is also sometimes known as Ghost Babel, although that's not the official title. But these are mostly Game Boy Color games. There's a couple of black and white and dual mode games on there, but they will play on your Game Boy Advance, GBA SP, Game Boy Player on your GameCube. So I'm really, really looking forward to this. These are some games that we haven't really talked about on the show very much at all, and it should be a lot of fun. So I also tried to pick games that are pretty easy to find, they don't cost too much, etc. So please go vote in the poll. You should have 2 or 3 days left to do so when this podcast comes out. And then next week, we will announce the winner and start procuring our copies of whatever game comes out on top. All right, that's it. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you guys for joining me and chatting and shooting the bull every week. That's going to do it. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Later.
So long.
The sad thing is the Pokemon, some of them can actually talk, like, English.
I know, so, it makes me better. Talk.
Yeah, let me yes. throw this sentient creature into mortal death so I can win some coins.
Look, I do that every day at work.
I'm just saying, Meowth versus Meowth should not be rated E.
Meowth on Meowth violence.
Meowth on Meowth strong.
So Johnny's taking this to his sad place, and John just goes ahead. So nope.
Yeah.
Fuck that.
It looks really good. I don't know, John, what you thought of it, but
John was too busy after about 10 minutes taking shots of things unrelated to the demo.
No, man, I stood there like a stone, man. I just
bull crap.
The funniest thing was at the end of it, Johnny was just like, "Okay, thanks." No, I mean, we were just so sick of standing there. I mean, and he showed the whole thing to us. It was awesome. But at the end of it, we're just like, "All right. We've been standing here for 20 minutes. Let's get out of here."
I'm pretty sure I had to take a shit really bad that whole time.
Yeah, that too.
I think I was ready to go, A, because I wasn't super hyped about the game, and B, because the only place I could stand was in front of the swag box, so I kept having to move every, 30 seconds.
I was, stuck off in a corner. I was practically falling over stuff. I was at, the most awkward position.
Yeah. It was not a meeting room.
No, definitely not.
It was on the sofa, floor. I think, that you kept tripping over, yeah. And I was sitting on a cardboard box.
Yep.
So.
Oh, God.